Ladies and gentlemen, a very warm welcome to the Marketing Society Amplify Festival, a three-day event across today, Wednesday and Friday this week. My name is Sophie Devonshire and I'm the CEO of the Marketing Society, and I am delighted to be welcoming you to this, the first Amplify Festival in a virtual format. I'm delighted to be welcoming you because I know we are all in for a treat this week with what we've got lined up. The Marketing Society is a global network of progressive marketing leaders, and we've been helping inspire and support the marketing community for over 60 years now. We help empower brave leadership in business across the world. And our hub in Scotland has been the base for a very special community of thinkers, debaters, dreamers, storytellers, and game changers, all of whom have a vision to build in Scotland a vibrant marketing community, renowned for enlightened thinking, innovation, and creativity, as well as promoting the value and appreciation of marketing from the classroom to the boardroom. Amplify Marketing Festival has been key to this for over a decade. The Marketing Society has developed a number of events during the Edinburgh Festival, and Amplify was the collective name for these events. The objective for them all has been to promote the value of marketing and creativity at the world's biggest art and cultural event. As in so many areas in our lives in 2020, things are a little different this time. But we at the Marketing Society are still committed to finding ways to inspire and energise people who see the value of marketing and creativity. And as well as our Ogilvy lecture today, which highlights the importance of great thinkers and inspiring speakers, another key part of our Amplify Festival is always supporting sparky and intelligent debate. So get ready for the Badger debate this Wednesday, as well as the Clients versus Agencies Creative Challenge, which is a great battle to discuss creativity and innovation. And these are all coming later this week. Much more on that later. Now, back to today and the Ogilvy Lecture. The Ogilvy Lecture is our way of expressing our desire to preserve and promote David Ogilvy's legacy. As a proud and passionate Scot, David Ogilvy was a self-claimed Scot. He went to school in Edinburgh and then set up Ogilvy and Mather New York and helped be part of one of the biggest and most famous advertising networks across this world. Ogilvy is one of the most celebrated names in our industry, and his books on marketing and advertising are still highly regarded and used today. This year's Ogilvy Lecture will be delivered by Mark Ritson, one of the world's most influential marketing professionals. And he is the latest in a long line of impressive speakers who have delivered the Ogilvy Lecture for the Marketing Society in Scotland, including Jan Gooding from Stonewall and Syl Salah, our president of the Marketing Society, and the inimitable Rory Sutherland, who will also be joining us in a moment to share some thoughts. So we've got Mark Ritson, Rory Sutherland, two of the most interesting and impressive minds in the marketing industry today, and probably two of the most passionate and sweary speakers you'll ever come across. Really looking forward to hearing from both of them today. But pleased though I am to be introducing these two, I'm even more pleased to say hello to all of you who have joined us today for this great festival. I know there's a huge number of you here listening today. There are some small advantages to running this event virtually. And one is that it's easier than ever for people across the world to join this virtual event and to be part of this Amplify Festival. But it is a bit of a shame not to be able to see each other and spend time together and to be able to chat more directly. The beauty of this system, though, is that, of course, you can all chat all the way through. You'll see at the bottom of your screen to the left, that there is a function for you to be able to come in and comment and chat. So I'd love to invite all of you listening to please sign on now and come and say hello. You can share your comments and share your questions for Mark to answer later. It's one of the benefits for me in the last 2 months of being part of the Marketing Society and seeing how much everybody appreciates listening to the perspectives and the points of view of their peers. So please come on and comment as we go. We will be doing a short question and answer session at the end of all this. And Mark has kindly offered a couple of things. One is that he will answer all the questions, if not today, in a follow-up as well. But he will also be giving a free place on his mini MBA for the best question that's posed. So a challenge for you all out there. Put your thinking caps on. Put your questions on that Q&A chat and there will be a prize for you. So let's just check that that chat channel is working. Could I please ask you all to come on and say hello? Tell us where you're dialing in from today. And let's think of a question that we can talk about. Given that Amplify is normally held at the Edinburgh Festival, which is a place where people come from all across the world to get their creative stimulus, I'd like to ask you, now you're working from home, where are you finding your creative stimulus? What is it you're doing to get that stimulus now you're working from home? Come and say hello on the chat channel and put your comments on there as well. I'm going to look at them as they come. Incidentally, David Ogilvy had a particularly good tip for creative stimulus. He always used to talk about not getting his ideas necessarily in the office, but often at home, particularly after dinner. Maybe after a bottle of wine, which helps you get in touch with the subconscious, he said. Okay, let's see some of your comments coming through here. Great to welcome you all. Check the chat is working. Hello, Ian from London. Lots of people coming from Edinburgh. Hi, Sarah. Ah, someone from Athens. How nice. Regular breaks and going for a run always gives me more energy. Where else are you getting your creative stimulus? Excellent. Glasgow. Hello, Oslo, Norway. Thank you very much. Please keep adding your comments about where you're getting your creative stimulus from and asking questions as we go through today's session. It's great to see you all here. So if anybody else would like to add any further questions, please add them on there. And remember, we're all obviously on Twitter as well. So the hashtag for today is hashtag Amplify2020 and the Marketing Society Scotland is at MarketingSocSEO. So that's Marketing SOCSEO or just at MarketingSoc on Twitter. Now, ladies and gentlemen, now you've all joined us, you've made sure the chat's working, you can sit back and enjoy the wonderful tones and thoughts of Rory Sutherland, author of The Wiki Man, and Alchemy, the surprising power of ideas that don't make sense. Rory is a behavioural science aficionado, vice chairman of Ogilvy, and fellow of the Marketing Society. And he's an incredible, likeable legend in the marketing industry. I was talking to a marketing director friend of mine last week and telling her about what we had planned for today. And she said, I could listen to Rory Sutherland talk all day. But I've been given very strict instructions, Rory, that we have to run to time. So we only have a little bit of time with you today. But I'm delighted that you're here. Hello, Rory. What have you been up to recently to keep your creative stimulus going?
Well, if you get a bit of seagull noise, I apologise in advance because I'm down by the sea in Deal where I've got a little flat. One of the joys of this whole lockdown is that the freedom to work from anywhere. I think one of the things we fail to understand is that when we take on a job, we sell our time, which is fair enough, but we've always assumed we had to sell the when and the where. Now, actually, if we can sell our time but enjoy a large amount of free when and free where, I shouldn't be saying this, but I'm happy to work for a bit less. I think the value of a degree of autonomy in where you work and when, without all the bollocks of having to travel in monotonously, is an extraordinarily beneficial value exchange between employer and employee.
Brilliant.
I'm kind of quite liking it. I shouldn't be saying that. So you'd like me to introduce this, and it's perfect, by the way, because what Mark's going to be talking about is effectively the need to embrace contradiction. And it's perfect that Mark should do that in something called the David Ogilvy Lecture, because David was pretty much the most contradictory bugger you could possibly imagine. The works of David Ogilvy are a little like the Bible. It's possible to find in the writings of David Ogilvy something that will support practically every position. He was a huge devotee in many ways of Claude Hopkins, of scientific advertising, and was a massive proponent of direct marketing and measurable scientific advertising. But he was also one of the first people to talk about the value of long-term brand investment. He was Rossa Reeves's, I think it was, brother-in-law, possibly son-in-law. And so he had one leg in that camp of kind of, you know, USP, hammer it into someone's skull advertising. And at the same time, he would always say things like, you cannot bore people into buying your product. And so he was a man who really contained multitudes. And it was never better put when he delivered a huge rant against advertising awards and how totally distorting and irrelevant they are, on the eve of Ogilvy winning the Grand Prix at Cannes for a Perrier commercial featuring the song I'll Put a Spell on You. How the hell do you get out of that one? You've just slammed awards and a day later your agency wins the Grand Prix. And he said, personally, I don't like the advertisement, but I accept the fact that there is a kind of advertisement that breaks every single rule in the book, but which is still brilliant and works. Now, his willingness to accept the fact that advertising works in multiple ways. I always remember, you know, one of his close friends, Drayton Bird, who worked with me, saying, you know, a foolish consistency is the hobgoblin of small minds. You have to accept that when you're operating in a complex system, like a marketplace, you're not looking for universal laws. Just give an example of this from science. Murray Gell-Mann, who's as close to being a kind of certified genius in the realm of physics, after winning the Nobel Prize for Physics, set up something called the Santa Fe Institute, which is an institute dedicated to the study of complexity. And the first thing he said is, once I decided to dedicate the rest of my life to complexity, I effectively acknowledged the fact that I was never going to make a scientific discovery in the conventional sense ever again. I wasn't going to be able to find a universal law. The best you could do is look for recurring patterns. I capture a bit of this in my book, Alchemy, a little bit of a plug, when I say that, you know, one of the problems with marketing in trying to make it scientific is that the opposite of a good idea can be another good idea. Okay. In physics, the opposite of a good idea is almost certainly wrong. In marketing, the opposite of a good idea can be another success story. And so one of the things I think is a problem is that in the effort to make marketing look scientific, and always bear in mind there are two reasons why you embrace science. One of them is to ask better questions and come up with better informed answers. The other one is less creditable. It's that by appearing to look highly rigorous in your methodology, you're insuring yourself against the risk of blame. Don't worry, you didn't miss anything. I was put on hold there while they sorted out the streaming tech. Now, what I was saying was that there's a problem which is caused by the fact that ad marketing is desperately trying to make itself more scientific than it can be, okay? And the reason that's a problem is very simple, which is when you try and make things look scientific, you try and look for universal, generalizable, eternal laws. And we don't operate in that space, and the maths we use correspondingly has to be different. Now, I don't know, I thought I'd give this a little bit of a Scottish flavour, and delving into, we left for Wales in the 19th century, we're originally from Latheron, so I consider all you Edinburgh people a bunch of basic effete southerners, to be honest, coming from Caithness, but I thought I'd give it a bit of a Scottish theme. And I dimly remember a TV series, and apologies to the people watching from overseas, called Highlander. And all I can remember about Highlander was there was some sort of person in America who was descended from some Highland chief. And the whole idea was that there could only be one. Is that right? Now, what tends to happen in marketing is people get obsessed with the idea that science means there's only one killer metric, or there's only one thing that marketing needs to do. And I think this is an extraordinarily dangerous self-limiting belief. Because what it does, agencies are particularly guilty of this. This is what an agency generally does, by the way. Okay, it takes its most famous and successful recent campaign, reverse engineers a methodology as to how they arrived at that idea, claims that that methodology is now the holy grail to all great advertising, and demands that every single brand that comes through their portal, if only it subjects itself to this methodology, will be able to generate equivalent success. Okay. And as a result, you create this incredibly narrowing application of marketing, which comes with a huge opportunity cost, because it confines marketing to a narrower and narrower function. And the reason that is so problematic is really important, because marketing is never going to be that simple. John Kay always argues this in economics. He says, everybody demands there's a single metric for businesses to pursue, he says, because as if nothing else is comprehensible. But he said, you know, I have a cleaner in every week. I set her about 5 or 6 different targets. She manages to cope with making the trade-off between those 6 targets perfectly well. I don't know why that shouldn't apply elsewhere in business. In the same way, we get obsessed with this idea of there can only be one. In other words, if one thing is true, then the obverse is false. And the reason it's dangerous, and I'm going to end here, okay, is because it hugely narrows the possible number of problems to which marketing can apply itself. I get ranty increasingly about agencies because I say, why are you always pursuing people with large media budgets? I said, we haven't been paid on commission since about 1990, okay? And yet your muscle memory is such that you obsess about 47 marketing directors who happen to have large media spend, despite the fact that for every person with a problem and a big media budget, there are 1,000 people with a problem who don't have a big media budget. I would argue that that marketing absolutely needs to step up to the plate. And I'm going to ask Mark to do this, and I'm going to ask most of you to do it as a bit of a pledge. Now, I acknowledge the fact that it's a bit Rosser Reeves. It's a bit repeating a mantra endlessly to get it into people's heads. But that's part of how advertising works. Okay. And what I'd like you all just to say, whenever you give a talk to other people or to non-marketers, just insert this perfectly outrageous statement, which is nonetheless possibly true, which is that the biggest obstacles to economic growth, the biggest obstacles to technological progress, and the biggest obstacles to ecological progress are now no longer questions of supply, they're questions of demand. The problems that economists have always defined as being, if only we can get manufacturing more efficient and the price lower, demand will appear, are fundamentally wrong. Why don't economists acknowledge this? Why don't policymakers acknowledge this? Why don't most people in a business board meeting acknowledge this and devote part of the board meeting to discussing marketing and psychological questions rather than operational questions? Well, the answer is most of your status lies in the original field. It's like getting cavalry officers in 1917 to admit the fact that maybe cavalry charges aren't the future of military combat. Too much status is vested in this idea that by looking at a balance sheet, you can somehow cost cut your way to growth, which is axiomatic within economics. Every time we give a talk as a marketer, we have to say, look, guys, the real obstacles, the bottlenecks, the slowdowns are no longer anything to do with what we can provide. They're to do with what people demand. And I think if you want proof of that, Bill Gates said a wonderful thing. The trouble nowadays is that people don't know how to want the things we can offer them. And I think COVID illustrates that perfectly. You had a technology in the shape of Zoom, which was perfectly mature 2 years ago, was extremely usable. And yet businesses did almost nothing with it until they were forced to by a complex mix of circumstances. No one was sitting down, apart from me, actually, a year ago saying, what can we do with this technology? How can we reinvent our business around it? It was a failure of wanting, of knowing how to want something, not a failure of supply. And I think every time a marketer gives a talk, they should assert that outrageous assertion. Because the problem of this Highlander approach, which is there can only be one methodology, marketing is all about one thing, is it massively narrows the potential solution space for where marketers can operate. And it ends up in, particularly in B2B organizations, where you become, you're only conversant with the marketing function, which outside of the big packaged goods companies is not a strategic or senior function at all. It's basically a support function. It's reprographics with a degree. Okay. And what we've got to do as marketers, we've got to learn to talk more broadly about what marketing can do. We've got to accept the contradictions, and we've got to talk to a wider audience. And we've got to continually reinforce this message that the principal obstacles to growth are almost certainly found in psychology and human and collective behavior. They're no longer found in what you can supply for how much. And we've also got to win one final other battle, which is that a large part of marketing works in lots of different ways, not all of which will be quantifiable or optimizable or predictable or measurable in retrospect. Okay. Now, if we set ourselves the rule that we can only do those things that are measurable, that serve a predefined goal, and which the effect of which we can measure in retrospect, we massively limit ourselves to what we can possibly do. Now, I recommend you all read, after you've listened to Mark's talk, a book called The Anatomy of Humbug by Paul Feldwick, where he makes this point much better and much more rigorously than I do, that marketing and advertising work in a lot of different ways. And I add a further way, which is entirely probabilistic. Nobody's ever said this, but a large part of advertising is if you're famous, you increase the chances of getting lucky. Maybe it's because people have heard of you, so they return your chief executive's phone call. Maybe it's because people come to you with good ideas. Maybe it's because people want to work for you. Maybe it's because people bring you ideas and suggest a partnership. You'll never know in advance, and you won't be able to measure it in retrospect. But does that mean you shouldn't try to be famous at all just because you don't know how it works at the microscopic level? My argument is no. The obsession with certainty and quantification is a strength in some areas, it's a massive limitation in others. If you want a bit more further evidence, before I hand back, if you want a bit more further evidence of this idea that the principal obstacles to growth are no longer anything to do with what economists talk about, it's not to do with the Fed, it's not to do with access to capital, it's to do with the psychological obstacles to behavior change. And that if you can remove those, you can grow faster. I'll just add one final list of about eight businesses, all worth $1 billion or more. Amazon Prime on its own, Starbucks, Nespresso, Red Bull, Dyson, okay? I can reel off a few more. All of them worth $1 billion. All of them make no sense in advance. If anybody had come to me and said in about 2006, I think there's a market for a 700-pound vacuum cleaner, I would have told them not to give up the day job, okay? If you'd asked anybody in 1996, okay, would you pay $3.50 for a cup of coffee? They would have said no. Five Guys, would you pay £9 for a burger? 90% of people would have said no. The other 10% would have told you to fuck off, okay? And yet all these companies are worth nigh on £1 billion because they've discovered something about human psychology that nobody else knew before. This is where the proper focus of business lies. And if we allow it to become relegated into a narrow quantification obsessed sideline, where all the effort is in self-justification rather than exploration, all the effort is focused towards exploit rather than explore, then we don't deserve increasing influence. And that's the problem we face. It's Highlander syndrome. And after a short introduction, Mark will tell you about that in a much better and more sweary way than I possibly can. So thank you all.
An even more sweary way. Yeah. Thank you, Rory. What a brilliant way to start off. I'm so much in there for about the Highlander syndrome and the psychological obstacles to behavior change being the impediment to growth for us all. The obsession with certainty as a massive limitation and you know, being famous to increase the chance of getting lucky. Some great food for thought there as we start the lecture off today. Thank you very much, Rory. And now I'm hoping that all the technical issues that people have had have been solved. Product supply problem. I know there is definitely a wanting and a desire there for people to hear what's next. So I, without further ado, I'd like to introduce Mark Ritson. Mark is a great teacher. He's a great thinker and he's a fantastic agent provocateur. He's worked across the years as a global brand consultant to many brands, from Subaru to Sephora, from McKinsey to WD-40. And he even spent 13 years in-house as the in-house professor for LVMH. He has a PhD in marketing and has been a professor right across the world at London Business School, Minnesota, Melbourne, and MIT Sloan. And now his teaching is available completely online with his mini MBA courses, which you can see at mba.marketingweek.com. And for one person listening today, there is a place available on that course for the best question that we receive on the chat function, which should now be working, I hope, perfectly, and for our questions and answers afterwards. Many of you will actually know Mark from his writing, his award-winning writing, including his Marketing Week column. As I was preparing for this introduction, it struck me that Mark Ritson reminds me very much of Jermaine Greer. There are not that many things that they have in common, but I saw Jermaine Greer speak a little while ago, where she said to her audience, "I don't care if you disagree with me. In fact, I want you to argue with me. But what I really, really want is that what I say makes you think." And the genius of Mark Ritson is that he is a challenging mind who helps both stimulate debate about marketing and also make us all think. And I'm completely thrilled that he is here today giving the annual Ogilvy Lecture for the Marketing Society. A very warm welcome and thank you, Mark Ritson.
Hello, Marketing Society members. It is I, your trusty virtual professor, Mark Ritson, and I'm honoured to deliver this year's Ogilvy Lecture to the Marketing Society members from Scotland and everyone else who's joining in this afternoon for this session. I'm delighted you're joining me, and I'd like to tell you a little bit of a long-winded introduction as to what I'm going to talk about. Okay, so let's go. I want to start with a pop quiz. I want to make sure you're paying attention. You ready? You should have by now read some version of the original or some pressy of The Long and the Short of It by the great Binet and Field. Sometimes referred to as Field and Binet, but clearly that's the wrong way around. It has a much better ring to it as Binet and Field. Anyway, they wrote The Long and the Short of It. And my question to you as we start this Ogilvy lecture is, which of those words in the title is the most important? Is it long or is it short? Take a moment. Which of those two is the more important implication, application for marketing professionals like you and me? Ready? The correct answer is neither of them. The most important word in that book of Les and Pete's is the word "and." Because it's quite unusual to have a marketing title, as we'll see as we go through this session, that includes that idea of multiplicity, both sides of the coin, inclusivity. As you'll see, it's really a rather lovely thing. And is indeed the most important word in that book. And this thought came back to me about a month ago when I read a very, very good post by an advertising planner, I hope he doesn't mind me calling him that, called Tom Roach. Tom's quite famous and very experienced and has been around the traps. And Tom wrote this really rather wonderful LinkedIn post called "The Wrong and the Short of It." And, you know, in all deference to Tom, there was nothing new in it, but it really was purely and beautifully written. And I was very impressed with it. And what Tom basically says, and I would encourage you to read it for yourself, is that obviously short-termism is a bad thing because we know it leads to suboptimal outcomes, even though ROI points us in that direction. But he also pointed out that long-termism is also a bad thing too, and you can go too much the other way. And he went further and said, look, Field and Burnett, and particularly Burnett, who Tom knows very well and works with, are not merchants of the long any more than they're merchants of the short. At the moment, there is a bias towards short-termism, so the two godfathers of effectiveness tend to push the long boat further. But that's not because they're into long-term stuff. It's that they like to do both and they feel there is an imbalance in the force. And what Tom keeps saying in this really rather lovely article, in a nutshell, is that we need to balance both approaches. Now, that sounds bloody obvious, but it's not obvious. It can't be obvious because most companies are skewed one way or the other, almost to the exclusion of the alternative. And everything Tom says really centres on a rather splendid chart where he looks at the two different approaches. If you work for a company, and the chances are you probably do, that's overtly short-term in focus, then you suffer from a rather restricted bit of tofu. Yeah, your top of funnel has too little demand, feeding the bottom of funnel where there's splendid performance marketing, wonderful conversion, amazing success. But because your top of funnel is weak, your bottom of funnel is only converting off a certain weaker base. And of course, the flip is true. If you work for a smaller but still equally stupid proportion of companies that are too long-term in their approach, well, you've got an amazing bit of tofu up the top. Yeah, you focus on those awareness consideration stages, but when it comes to converting, your website's shit, you don't spend enough money probably on digital marketing, and generally the performance of your conversion is shithouse. And the irony of all this is, of course, that if you go too short or too long, the ultimate financial outcome from different paths is equally disappointing. Either limited long-term growth or limited short-term sales. Either way, to use the economic term, you're going to be fucked eventually. And of course, the point that Tom concludes with is what we want to do is balance out long and short, tofu and bofu. Now, not necessarily, as we'll see later, 50-50 or even 60-40. That's a naive and simplistic approach. But the point is to acknowledge both sides. And then to go further, to blend them together in the appropriate mix to be a better marketer and work for a more successful brand. Now, what's interesting about this is it made me think. So let me give you my explanation for why most companies are still very short term. And then I'm going to flick to Tom's, okay? Because Tom's might be better. So, as you probably know, we've had the long and the short of it for a decade as a theory, but most companies aren't just ignoring it, they're continuing to be increasingly focused on short-termism. Why is that? Here's my explanation from what I've seen firsthand. I mean, just pull this out of the air. This is what I've seen in organisations I've worked for and with. Now, you're familiar with the Burnett and Field model, Field and Burnett. Sales uplift over base on the Y-axis. On the x-axis, the period of time that 2-3 years might be appropriate. Now, as you know, there are two different lines of growth. There's a short-term performance marketing line. We put our foot on the pedal, and sales go up. The minute we take our foot off the pedal, up, the sales go whoop back down to where they were before. Not a bad thing, because the amount of money and effort on the pedal is more than offset by the return in sales that we're getting. The alternative curve, the blue curve of brand building in contrast, is a more incremental and slower, but ultimately equally rewarding trajectory. And as we know, this isn't the story of long versus short, it's the story of them together producing the short-term results to fill the long-term impact, which feeds the short-term results, and that lovely wheel begins to turn and a brand begins to grow. So how come a theory so simple and so empirically now supported is still largely ignored by most organizations when we look at how and where they're spending their marketing dollars. And the answer, in my opinion, comes down to a simple observation. And the observation is, this is great when you have some kind of eternal time principle on the x-axis, but every company you, I, and everyone else we know has ever worked for lives here in this 12-month planning cycle box. We think in 12-month financial cycles. We all do at the end of the day. Yeah. Now, when you glimpse those famous two lines within that cage of 12 months, look at what we see. Brand building looks, frankly, like a suboptimal approach. And performance marketing, sales activation, conversion, whatever we want to call it, is delivering the money big time. Maybe with a better ROI that's twice that of brand building, three times that of brand building. Only a mug would spend money on the blue stuff when I can get me the red stuff with a much better ROI. Now, as you know, if you're pretty good at marketing, ROI is only half a measure. It's good for the short. It sends you in exactly the wrong direction for the long. And that's why it's kind of a shitty metric. Don't tell everyone because some people are still in love with it. And the point is, what happens is Groundhog Day. Every year we go, well, I'm going to get more money from investing in short-term performance marketing, so that's what I'll do this year. Next year you go, well, I'm going to get more from that, and that's what we'll do, and that's what we'll do, and that's what we'll do. So my explanation for why we've been dramatically shorter than we should have been in recent years is because of the budgetary pressures of a 12-month cycle. Now, Tom takes a completely different point of view. What Tom says in his Wrong and Short of It article is, first of all, explaining what we've all known, long-term growth always has its roots in the short term. The two are connected, influence each other. And if you get the two working perfectly in harmony, you'll achieve the strongest, most sustainable growth possible. Amen to that. So why isn't it happening, according to Tom? But we so often miss out on maximizing growth in this way because of our binary belief systems, the organization silos we inhabit, the different job titles we have, the different channels and formats we tend to use, and the different metrics we try to optimize. For Roach, the reason why short is favored over long is tribal, it's cultural, it's sociological. People see the world one way or another. It's not as rational as my explanation, and probably as a result, more accurate. So anyway, I thought this was a pretty good post, and I attempted to pass it off as my own work, as I like to with all brilliant work, with a very tight sentence saying how brilliant it was, hoping people would then read it on my LinkedIn feed, assuming that I had actually written it. I'm a huge fan of this work. And sure enough, thousands of people read it and commented on it, hopefully some of them believing it was written by me rather than Tom. People said all kinds of brilliant things about it, as you can see here. But it was Dave Thomas's comment, which came in about a week later than when I made the original post, that really struck me, if anything, as even more interesting than Tom Roach's original column. Dave Thomas said, and I quote in his LinkedIn post, "Technically, this will become known as the development of the Bothism model, led by the brand is the protein and the sales is the workout thinking." Now, as a relatively fat man who's never been anywhere near a gym, except once when I had to meet a girl and then go for a massive Italian meal, I don't really know what that reference at the end is to protein, sales and all that shit. But I really liked that one thing that he put in there, Bothism. I thought, is Bothism a thing? And it turns out it's not a thing. It doesn't really exist. David Thomas had invented it. So I thought, as you now know, well, I'll steal that without telling Dave Thomas, and I'll start using it in my various different interactions, like, oh, that marketing society talk I've got to give in a month's time. So, behold, Dave Thomas and the rest of the marketing society, here is your David Ogilvy lecture, and it's titled, what do you know, Marketing Bothism. So, what do I mean by marketing bothism? Well, first we have to define bothism, which doesn't actually exist. So I'm going to make it up because I'm allowed to. Bothism is a noun, I think, and the definition I've created is the rare capacity to not only see the value of both sides of the story, but actively consider and then co-opt them into any subsequent marketing endeavor in an appropriate mix. There's a lot going on there, but I figure if I'm going to invent something, albeit something I've pretty much stolen, I get to have a few words to create it. Now, note the antonyms there, because they're far more familiar to marketers. Speciality, isolation, silos, either, or, exclusion. Bothism is the opposite of that, as you can see from the definition, and I want to explore it in this particular Ogilvy talk. So let me give you an example of how this plays out on a simple level, right? Ever since marketing has begun, or at least since I've known about marketing, which is getting to be a very long time now, we've had this eternal discussion between quantitative research, and you all know this, the power of conjoint or whatever the hell else, recently bolstered by machine learning, artificial intelligence, but the power of quantitative numbers and the fact that they're far more powerful than the weak, frail, relatively artistic and unreliable qualitative research. If you ever spend time in a business school, you'll discover that almost everyone doing an MBA thinks that quant is it, and anything else is not to be even contemplated. It's scientific. But then we have the other side of the coin, which is, of course, the more touchy, feely, meaning-based idea of qualitative research. Shut up! Sorry. Qualitative research. The deep insights of qualitative. It's inductive. It's ideographic. And of course, we have then the weakness of quantitative, much espoused by qualitative researchers, which is, you know, the observer cannot be separated from the object and therefore we must do qualitative and engage and so forth. You can play this debate out forever. And in reality, if we take the view of marketing bothism, we'd see there is a way out of this jungle. And by the way, we can continue this all day long talking about ethnography versus focus groups or conjoint versus online research. You can do it within each method as well. So let's remind ourselves, the weakness of qual is very simple. It can never be representative data. Therefore, there can never be any sense of what the small group in qual will transpose to the overall market. Therefore, we cannot have any form of representation. Therefore, we cannot have any quantification. 9 people out of 9 in a focus group can say they like the thing. It will not transpose onto the total population. That in itself means we can't do magnitudes or causality or any of the other cool shit that quantitative people like to do. Qual is indeed fluffy. But before this turns into a beating up qual session, let's flip it around. What is the weakness of quant? This is less talked about, but equally limiting. The weakness of quant is, if you measure the wrong shit quantitatively, you're equally fucked as just doing qualitative and then trying somehow to add the numbers to it. Let me explain with the stupid example I use on my mini MBA. I say to my students, next week, you have a choice of how I deliver the online lectures. Option A, I can deliver it in swimwear. And this is exactly how it looks. Or option B, I can deliver next week's class stark bollock naked. Choose A or B. And I give them a little questionnaire. Sure enough, perhaps no surprise, every fucker in the class votes for A, speedos. Yeah? And I kick off the session. Halfway through the session, the head of marketing week rings me up and says, Mark, it's inappropriate, particularly with your body, to be teaching the mini MBA this week in swimwear. Put some clothes on, man. And I say to Russell, hey, chill out, Russell. I asked all of the students on my mini MBA program last week, what would they like me to do? 100% of them said, we want you in speedos, Ritson, get it off. And I'm only giving the market, therefore, what they want. You see my point. It's a stupid, silly example, but it illustrates a key challenge that quant on its own is invariably, but often invisibly, flawed because we know that A, B, and C measure accordingly. But if we didn't include X, Y, and Z in our measurements, then all of our numbers are actually off. What does that teach you? It teaches you that research should be approached with bothism, that actually qual and quant in the appropriate levels together are always the right answer. And if you only take one over the other, you are effectively doing the wrong thing. Let's take another example from marketing, a classic one, strategy versus creative. You've all encountered the creative uber alles philosophy in marketing and advertising. Some old guy who's earned $1 billion sits at the top of a building with his name on it and says, listen, creativity is the ultimate advantage. You'll never be able to survive without creativity. The consulting firms won't manage it because they're not creative enough. You need creativity to be successful. It's the ace of spades in the poker game of marketing. And to some degree, that's partly true. But then you get the other side, which has been growing recently and kind of blows my mind. In my lifetime working on brands, originally nobody said they were a strategist or a brand strategist. I don't know what the fuck that means, yeah? You can do brand strategy, sure, if you're an account planner or a brand manager or just a marketer. But since when did it become some kind of title? And also, it's interesting, everyone's now talking about strategy is this or that. You know, strategy is storytelling. What the fuck does that mean? Anyway, I digress. The point is, you got strategy and you got creative. Now, can I just interject for 1 second and explain what strategy is? I couldn't resist. It's kind of off topic, but I'm going to do it anyway. When we do strategy in marketing, at least, we just need to answer the key questions. All that arse about strategy is colours and walking through the park and having beautiful, all that nonsense. It's really not that hard, right? Pretend you're a plumber, right, instead of a philosopher. So all marketing strategy or brand strategy is first of all working out who we're going to target, then working out what the positioning is, then setting up some pretty decent objectives to drive our activity, and a little bit of brand architecture, I find, just to work and make sure we're applying the right brands to the right questions. But that's kind of what it is. All the rest of it is just kind of a lot of wank that surrounds the topic. Anyway, I digress. The point of this slide is to say there is a growing tension between these two areas. I'll give you an example, and I apologize here. I'm quoting someone called Don Draper. I'm pretty sure he's not called Don Draper, but he might be, and my apologies if he is. Anyway, Don Draper recently tweeted, why do strategists think that being a strategist is a personality trait? Laugh my ass off. Almost immediately, someone from the strategy community who found that offensive tweeted back, Michael Cates, why do creatives think they're the only ones who get to have ideas? Now, you see what's going on here. It's a classic, simple example of an eye for eye, half a coin each approach. And it's ludicrous, right? It's ludicrous because literally strategy needs creative and creative needs strategy. And if you don't believe me, just study your basic marketing history. The point of a creative brief is to be the bridge between the final strategic decisions and the creative execution that follows. They literally have to be part of the bothist philosophy because they're connected right in the bloody middle. So you see my point again. So when I say bothism, and I'm really going to try and make this catch, right? I'm really having a go at this with you guys from the Marketing Society because I think we should try this. Anyway, when I say bothism, what I first mean is we need to hunt down and remove the tyranny of the or. Now, that isn't something that I invented. It actually was invented by Jim Collins, who wrote Built to Last. It's not a bad airport book. And Jim Collins turns out to be that rare thing, a guru who's actually pretty good. Yeah. Anyway, here's the Jim Collins quote that I read when I started to hunt down this idea of bothism, because he's definitely got it worked out on a broader corporate strategy level. Collins says, in his introduction to Built to Last, you'll notice throughout the rest of this book that we use the yin-yang symbol from Chinese dualistic philosophy. We've consciously selected this symbol to represent a key aspect of highly visionary companies. They do not oppress themselves with what we call the tyranny of the or, the rational view that cannot easily accept paradox, that cannot live with two seemingly contradictory forces or ideas at the same time. The tyranny of the or pushes people to believe that things must be either A or B, but not both. This is what I'm talking about. We do this in marketing all the time. And I think we should stop because Jim seems a pretty smart guy. And this seems like a load of bullshit to me. Let me go further. So let's take the classic example of stupid, fucked up binary thinking. Okay? For the last 15 years, we've been arsing on about digital communications, digital advertising, and digital marketing, yeah? And we had to create something that wasn't digital. So we invented traditional communications, traditional advertising, traditional marketing, and a whole host of bearded and non-bearded sockless wonders have gone off explaining why this is better than that. And a few old paunchy people have said, well, actually, this is actually sometimes better than that. We're all missing the point completely. Bothism shows us the way. And by the way, I'm not inventing false dialogue here. This is all recent stuff. Look, social media versus traditional media. Make the transition to digital marketing, right? As if they're two completely different things. Or even better this week, online media versus traditional media. Who's the king now, motherfuckers? Yeah? Again, it's just ludicrous, superficial, two-dimensional thinking. And made all the more stupid by the fact that right now we sit on this period where so-called traditional and so-called digital are about 50% each. So, there are three problems with this ridiculous binary approach to comms. First of all, let me illustrate again with a second pop quiz. Which of these three formerly traditional media are now more digital? Is it A, newspapers? Is it B, radio? Or is it C, outdoor advertising? Which of those three would you regard as the least traditional and most digital now? The answer? It's all of them. All of these media now derive far more than 50% of their audience and or revenues from digital communications. Any newspaper still in business making money is making far much more money and getting far more eyeballs from its online digital presence than things printed on paper. We long ago, more than 18 months ago, passed the point in the United Kingdom where radio was listened to more on a broadcast platform than via a digital platform. It's now a digital medium. And outdoor has been revolutionised by digital screens. There's very little paper around in Edinburgh or Glasgow anymore. It's all digital. So it kind of means that the term digital communications is pointless. The only pure play traditional media I can think of is that weird loony bloke that walks around the old town in Edinburgh with that sign saying the end is nigh. He may not be there anymore, but last time I was in Edinburgh, he definitely was. He's traditional. Everything else now is definitely a blend. The second reason why this is a nonsensical binary divide is consumers don't care. Digital, traditional. Try explaining to a 17-year-old how they're mixing together the traditional and digital worlds that they inhabit while looking at their phone and watching TV. It's just something the industry invented. No one else has a problem with these two silos. But finally, and the most important point, is we miss, when we do this binary separation, the wonderful synergies that can be had from mixing and matching different media, especially from the traditional and digital world. I'll give you a good example this week. So I don't know Kevin Gibbons. I'm sure he's a fantastic person. In fact, I know he must be a fantastic person because he was UK Search Personality of the Year 2018. Wowzers. Anyway, Kevin posted something on LinkedIn that said, a quiz, which activity do you find moves the needle the most on organic search performance? Is it technical SEO, on-site content, or digital PR? Not PR, digital PR. And people voted. And then I saw this and thought, hello, this smacks of hypocrisy to me. And so I posted a helpful comment. And my comment, first of all, introducing myself as traditional marketer of the year 1992, was, what a shame mass media wasn't option number four. Because I know, and I suspect Kevin knows, that the best way to move the needle on organic search isn't any of those three stupid options. It's to take out a TV ad or outdoor or, God forbid, radio. So I voted for number four, mass media, and 323 people agreed with me. Now, my point again is that's a bothist approach, is it not? And that above is the opposite. So, communications, we must take a bothist approach, and it wouldn't be a decent presentation without a nice database slice from the wonderful company Analytic Partners, who recently, 2020, looked into the synergies that take place when you combine two media together. Now, if we take, for example, all of those nice media over there and we add something else, usually from the other side of the digital traditional spectrum, look what happens to the overall effectiveness of the different media when we take a bothist approach. For example, If you take an out-of-home campaign, put a little money into search, you get a 5% bonus on performance. Not from extra money, but from just spreading a little bit of the existing money across to a different tool. Even better, if you take that out-of-home money and slide a little bit onto online video, you get an almost 20% return. And best of all, look at TV and online video. What does that tell you about bothism? For 10 years, we've been having an argument with ourselves about YouTube, ITV, YouTube, ITV. Guess what the answer was? Do them both at the same time and split your budget. Look what you get. A 35% incremental synergy by taking the bothist approach. Why do we keep not getting this message? Look at the synergies that happen when you mix tools together. Bothism works. Diversity works. Inclusivism works. Let's do it more. So, communications, another example of bothism benefiting marketing. Let's take positioning, right? You know the story here. We spent about 50 years banging on about differentiation. First, Rosser Reeves talked about the USP, the unique selling proposition. It was a total load of balls. There's no such thing as a unique proposition that no one else can't eventually claim. But Rosser didn't care because it was 1962. He was smoking a lot of cigarettes. And frankly, no one was really paying attention. Then we got to the 70s and Jack Trout wrote, differentiate or die. The opposite of both is die. You're going to die if you don't differentiate, right? The ultimate anti-bothist approach. And more recently, we've had Simon Sinek just making lots of shit up with circles about how people really look carefully at companies and assess them based on how they... Absolute horseshit. Anyway, meanwhile, we've now swung across to the other end of the street. Our colleagues from Ehrenberg Bass have made a very important and empirical input into the process by pointing out that differentiation has been wildly overstated. And the real key, the real answer to positioning your brand for success is distinctiveness. It doesn't mean the same thing as differentiation. It's a far more low-key, realistic objective. And let me be clear. Ehrenberg Bass have done a good thing here, right? To take us away from this bullshit and swing the needle that way is good. But note they have swung the needle completely the other way. And to be fair again to them, most of their work is taken to extremes by others who don't really fully understand what they're saying. But nonetheless, you can feel this pendulum swing from differentiate or die. No. Distinctiveness. So many conferences in the last year, someone's got up and said, there's no such thing as differentiation. All brands are perceived to be the same. Sure they are. Again, bothism would triumph for us here. Why make a false choice? I agree Ehrenberg Bass are correct in the sense that distinctiveness has been overlooked and is inarguably more important in most cases than differentiation. But it doesn't mean we can't have both. And if you work on a decent brand, and I know a few good brand managers and CMOs, what you've got is a very tight explanation of your DNA, your purpose, your values, whatever you want to call it. That's the intended differentiation, yeah? And then you've got, because you know what you're doing, an equally tight list of codes or distinctive assets or whatever you want to call them, which are the way in which you achieve distinctiveness. Here's the key point. You need to have both of these in place, but you need to have them on a single page. And if you don't, and trust me, I know a lot of billion-dollar brands that do, you've gone too far. You don't need 7 words over here or 3 words over here for different concepts. You need a handful of words that describe what you want to be differentiated on, and you won't own it, but you could relatively be it. And then equally, if not more important, the set of distinctive assets or codes that you will mercilessly apply in order to stand out in the marketplace. But the point is, have both. It's a false choice. And while we're at it, we've got to go after Professor Sharp again. He is the most important and influential thinker in marketing, and that means he's also got a lot of other anti-bothist ideas. Mass marketing, let's go after that one, right? He said recently, textbooks have condemned mass marketing to a premature grave. Rather than trying to hem their brands into niches, good marketers are always looking for broad reach. You know this. One of the biggest impacts of Ehrenberg Bass has been, and it is a remarkable tale, to turn around the perspective of the marketing community globally that mass marketing is bad and persuade them that actually, within a few parameters of sophisticated mass marketing, it actually makes more sense. Now, when Sharpe does this, he runs directly against the traditional marketing corpus. And this hombre over here, Theodore Ted Levitt, probably the greatest thinker in the history of marketing. And look at that hair, right? The point I would make to you is that when Theodore Levitt said, if you're not thinking segments, you're not thinking, he set in place a 50-year revolution that said STP. Along comes Sharpe, who says, not so fast. Actually, mass marketing isn't so dumb. This is one of the great moments in the history of marketing, and it only happened relatively recently. Now, you know probably that I have a dog in this hunt. About 3 years ago, I had a big debate, that's me over there, with Professor Sharpe on this very topic. Professor Sharpe made the case for mass marketing. I made the case for targeting. It was a big event at the Festival of Marketing in London. Now, I don't want to talk about the results or the outcome of that vote. That's not important. And we are in a session that's talking about bothism. So I don't want to go, oh, where'd that come from? Look at that. Anyway, I don't want to go on about that triumph. I mean, it is a massive smashing. What I want to talk about is that, oh, I don't know what's going on here with this keyboard. But what I want to talk about, oh, look at the size of that thing. 59% went with me. That's a dramatic, anyway, you get the point. The point is you can play either case, and this is meant to be a bothism talk, not a debate about who's right and who's wrong in some kind of gladiatorial contest. Last year, however, the Effies invited me to look at all of their thousands, as you can see over there, of submissions for Effies over the last 50 years and see if I could draw some empirical patterns, albeit in a loose way, from the data. Well, one of the things I was most interested in was finding out if my rhetoric, which had won the day in the conference, was actually true. I was able to split up all the campaigns that overtly went after target segments, which is what I was fighting for, or went with sophisticated mass marketing in the category, which is what Professor Sharpe argues for, and just look at which ones had the most effectiveness when we gave each a score for its overall impact on the market. Well, when we looked at the target segment campaigns, they averaged a score of 0.35. Pretty good compared to the overall total set. And then when we looked at the mass marketing approaches, we discovered that they only got 0.45. Fuck, as we stay in statistics, Professor Sharpe was correct. And he is right, by the way, and he deserves kudos because he's reversed that whole perspective of mass marketing being bad and proven his case innumerable times. But look over there, that isn't chopped liver. Target segmentation also seems to deliver some effectiveness too. So what's going on? What's going on is we should take a bothist approach to targeting. If you go back and look at short-term performance marketing using the work of Field and Burnett, what you discover from their IPA data is that when we look at short-term activation effects, big ones, the best impact you're going to get is still from that black bar of targeting existing customer segments. Segmentation and targeting still plays here. But the big revolution is when you go for brand building, when you go for big long-term brand building stuff, Professor Sharpe is exactly right. And the biggest annual market share growths that Burnett and Field observe come from targeting both existing segments and new segments, essentially the whole of the category. So it's possible to take both perspectives here. And when I work with companies more and more, I try and propose a two-speed brand planning approach. What I mean by that is we do our diagnosis and our segmentation as a single unitary thing, because it's about the market. But then I propose that they split their marketing planning at that point into two different budgets and two different approaches, long and short. The long is mass marketed. It's about everyone in the category. It's about delivering on a clear brand position and obviously codes. It has brand building objectives measured through brand tracking and the appropriate tactics, which tend to be obviously more emotional, more mass, slightly not completely swayed away from digital. But then, we also have the other split, which is devoted to target segmentation, short-term 12-month activation. Here we're going to position products with very tight objectives and the appropriate tactics, more digital, more product-based, more activation-oriented, to deliver that growth. Long and short, mass and targeted, bothism before your eyes. And the key point, there may be many target segments in a particular marketing year. So, again, a two-speed brand plan and the idea of targeting. Now, let's go further, because Jim Collins is even better than I've already said to you, because he doesn't just talk about the tyranny of the or, he also talks about the genius of the and that is what I want from this session. Collins says, instead of being oppressed by the tyranny of the or, highly visionary companies, why not marketers, liberate themselves and the genius with the genius of the and, the ability to embrace both extremes of a number of dimensions at the same time. Instead of choosing between A or B, they figure out a way to have both A and B. The genius of the and. Now, why aren't we doing this? Well, we see ourselves in marketing as fundamentally inclusive, diverse people. We welcome diversity. We make ads about diversity. We encourage inclusivity. We do all that to some degree with our work and even with our offices. But when it comes to our ideas, we don't do any of that shit. When it comes to our thinking and our models and our theory development, we are the Kim Jong-il of theory development. There can only be one answer, and it's better than the other shit answer. Why is that? Why are we so tyrannical about ideas? A couple of reasons. First, there are a bunch of agencies who have to sell an approach, a trademark system that's better than the other shit system in order to get ahead. We've been struggling with that for a long time. Marketing science. Look, I'm not a huge fan of marketing science. It's done some good things, yeah? It's pushed evidence to the fore. That's a great thing. It's made us more rigorous over the last 10 years. That's a great thing. But science, at least the Popperian falsificationist view of science, talks about there being ultimately only one tentatively held answer until we can disprove it and replace it with another. This is not bothism. This is the opposite of bothism. And marketing science has contributed to, that's wrong, this is right, put your test tubes out there, let's work out the answer. Social media has also become, over the last 5 to 10 years, a giant pissing contest in which I'm going to show you that I'm right by proving that you're wrong. We all do it. It makes for interesting interactions and, crucially, lots of follows and notoriety. But it doesn't help the process of bothism. And then we have the pornography of change, something that most marketers are absolutely obsessed with. The pornography of change is built upon this idea that what's happening now and next is better than what happened before. You can't have a bit of the old and a bit of the new. The new has to be better than the old, which was stupid and outdated. Behold new, hate the old. And again, it hurts us from a bothism point of view. And at the heart of all this is the great irony that marketing doesn't have one way, doesn't have one dominant approach, one successful path. It isn't physics. Marketing isn't gravity. The consumer is reflective. Culture moves and shimmers and changes. And because of all those different paths and options, we have many different sticks with which we can beat each other. And maybe a last point, if you look at the lovely work of Reach Solutions over the last 12 months, they've demonstrated very clearly that actually, rather than diversity, most of the people who work in marketing in the UK, as opposed to the consumers they target, come from AB backgrounds when they were growing up. It's quite a non-diverse group of people. Probably no surprise, therefore, that they kind of all agglomerate together, thinking this is the right answer versus that. There isn't enough diversity in our discipline. We talk about it, but we ain't got it. So, one last point, which will make the case for why I believe marketing bothism is so important. There's a wonderful little-known concept called contronyms. Contronyms are a fascinating lexical construct. They're words, and there's about 75 of them. They're words which actually mean the opposite of themselves within the same word. Let me explain by giving you an example. Quantum. Quantum is either something so enormous you can't envisage it, or so tiny you can't envisage it. A less fancy one. Rent. I could tell you I'm renting my apartment. What does that mean? Does it mean that I'm receiving money from someone, or does it mean I'm paying money to someone? Rent means both things, both directions. Wind up. That can mean to start something up, or it can mean to bring it back down again. Trip, I'm going on one, or I've had one, means either I'm making progress or I've just fallen down. You get the idea. Now, I want to add marketing as the 76th contronym, which makes bothism a particularly important facet. Why is marketing a contronym? Well, think about what we really do when we do our jobs well. On the one hand, we're always in listening mode. Empathetic, learning, market orientation, research, segmentation, which is fundamentally descriptive. This is about respecting and learning and understanding and taking our coordinates from the market. In contrast, we also have that other part of us, that part that wants to change the market. We want to persuade. We want to do stuff. We want to target. We want to position. We want to set objectives for change. We want to communicate. We want to listen and we want to change. We want to respect and we want to alter. Marketing is fundamentally a contronym. Now, the two things are linked together, of course, but don't make the mistake, the oversimplistic mistake of assuming I need to do 50-50. One of the things about marketing bothism, if you look back at my definition, is it's not necessarily about half here and half there. It's in the appropriate amount, and that amount might change from time to time. This is another point that Jim Collins makes as he talks about this idea of the tyranny of all. He says in his book, we're not talking about mere balance here. Balance implies going to the midpoint, 50-50, half and half. A visionary company doesn't seek balance between short and long term, for example. It seeks to do very well in the short and very well in the long. You get the point. There's a subtle nuance there. And he goes on to say, in short, a highly visionary company doesn't want to blend yin and yang into grey. Indistinguishable circle that is neither highly yin nor highly yang. It aims to be distinctly yin and distinctly yang, both at the same time, all of the time. That is the challenge of marketing bothism. Not to have a little bit of that and a little bit of this, but actually to keep them separate and let their dualities play off each other to the appropriate level of success. And that is my challenge to you, Marketing Society member. I'm not going to make this about 2020. 2020 is officially a shithouse, write-off, survive, lock yourself in your bedroom year. Nothing amazing or good is going to happen this year other than a massive piss-up on December the 31st. I turn my attention instead to 2021 and the gleaming green pastures of the future. This is the year I believe we should push marketing bothism through and towards our discipline. I believe this is the year where we should start to see marketing as a fundamentally bothist pursuit, where we don't tolerate any one approach, but we open ourselves to all the sides of the equation and blending them together, where we adapt ourselves to both forms of research, where we open ourselves to mass and targeting, where positioning becomes differentiation and distinctiveness, where short-termism is matched with long-termism in the appropriate balance, where communications is neither traditional or digital, it's just an optimum mix of different tools. This will be my challenge to you for 2021. So let's get into that mode. Let's start to practice through 2020 to prepare ourselves for bothism and 2021. When you want to vote, think about Boris and Kia. When you want to get drunk, think about gin and tonic. When you think about singers, it's both Benny and Bjorn. When you think about bands, this is a hard one for me, it's Blur and also Oasis. And when you think about bands, it's Duran and Duran. When you think about organs, it's both the cock and the pussy. The pussy and the cock. When you think about companies, it's Unilever and it's P&G. When you think about teams, it's both Celtic and Rangers. What? I've gone too far. I knew it. I'd gone too far with the football clubs. But you get my point. Both together, being themselves differently, but combining together for an amazing and astonishing combined effect. It's about heroes, David and Ogilvy. It's about this lecture on marketing bothism from me, your presenter, Mark Ritson. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mark. My head is slightly buzzing now with questions I want to ask you and things we want to talk about. And I've also just been laughing out loud listening to that today. Thank you so much for that. Lots of questions from me, but actually what I'd like to do now is just ask a few of the questions that have come through from the audience around marketing bothism. And I suspect Rory will also have some points of view on all this as well. Rory, listening to that, do you have any particular questions for Mark other than when should the two of you set up a drinking game where everybody drinks each time one of you swears, because that would be a great evening.
It'd be extremely dangerous, I think. The interesting question is, I think it applies, and I'm interested to know Mark's view on this, it also applies not only to timescale and to digital versus analogue, but also big versus small. And one of the things when I started the behavioural science practice is I had this mantra, dare to be trivial. Because you have this problem where if you have a particular sized budget, you start looking to solve problems in a way that's commensurate with the amount of money you've got to spend. And I'd always argue, look, we're doing this huge presentation on, you know, some branding aspect, but on their web page, there's a button where instead of saying buy this shit now, it says find out more. And you would sell 20% more if you changed find out more to buy this now. Okay. And everybody would look at me as if I was some sort of diva. Because so one of the interesting, okay, here's an even more interesting question. Board meetings, which are unbelievably non-fluffy and quantitative, do we need to change corporate governance? Since the board meeting is the only point at which silos are broken down, and since the CEO is the only guy who can really operate across discipline groups, do we need to have a shadow board meeting in which you're allowed to be fluffy? I mean, I noticed this working at Ogilvy, okay? When I first went onto the board at Ogilvy, someone would share a problem and I'd come up with a psychological solution, not a quantitative solution. And I kind of felt like I'd shat myself. I felt I'd defiled myself, because in a board meeting setting, you're not supposed to make suggestions that involve adjectives. And do you think there's a problem in corporate governance at the top, which is the board meeting has become an absurdly kind of quantitative entity, where you're not allowed to talk about trivia and you're not allowed to talk about psychology? Those are kind of two unwritten rules.
I'm quite boring on boards, Rory. I think we're out of step from there. I mean, you know, we're the ones that I'm not very, my limited exposure to boards has always been pretty bad. But I think we're the ones out of step and they're the ones in charge of the disco. Do you know what I mean? And I think we tend in marketing to complain about the CFO and complain about the boards not understanding this or understanding that. Not what you're saying, which is fascinating, but I think in marketing it tends to be a bit of a cliche that, you know, ooh, the evil CFO is forcing short-termism upon us. No, she's not. It's mostly marketers that aren't good enough to operate in a boardroom level that is our major problem and start a dialogue and work on their basis. I think that's always been our struggle. You know what I mean? I don't think we'll ever change the dynamics of the board. I think we've got to be good enough to just be involved in it. Do you know what I mean? And I think I don't think enough CMOs are good enough to handle proper executive life, unfortunately. Some are, but not many.
It's a different audience, isn't it? It's a different audience to understand, but a really, really important one to make sure that people learn how to connect and communicate with them. I think.
Yeah, but Sophie, we're meant to be good at that. I think you're absolutely right.
I know. The irony of it.
To be able to understand different audiences and deliver messages, right? And we just seem to fail, I don't know, 80% of the time.
Yeah. I think it is particularly hard right now, the two-pace race, the making sure we can survive today and then thrive tomorrow and getting that side of it all for people. There's a couple of questions coming through, though, about when did this dualism start and what's keeping it so popular?
Yeah, I don't know. I think we've kind of had this, I think we've had DNA in the marketing discipline for a long time that, you know, if you go back to above the line and below the line, which, you know, Rory will know better than me, but I think it's about, what is it, P&G, and it's about 70 years ago, Rory?
That's right. And it still exerts its influence 70 years later, yeah.
It does. And it never really made any sense, right? It was an accounting standard. But we liked it. And so we stayed with that. And, you know, I'm now old enough to remember when it was, you know, advertising and promotions were the two sort of, you know, diametric forces of communications. We like this stuff. And again, it's not something from my limited exposure to operations or finance you see as much of it going on. We like to play out these two extremes. I think we're into it more. So I think it's always been in our DNA. I don't think it's a new thing to find ourselves sort of spatchcock down the middle.
And there's something terrible about human psychology, which is what makes you get up out of your armchair and look out of the window? And the answer is a fight on the street. Okay.
Yeah.
So anything that involves, you know, if you hear people amicably discussing something on the street, you stay watching television. The second there's a fight, you're there, nose pressed to the window. And we can't resist disagreement. And so the areas on which we disagree get disproportionately more attention than common sense. This is probably true in politics as well, by the way.
Very much so.
There's probably a whole unexplored area of politics where if you sat a bunch of people on the left and the right together, they could actually agree on things. Those get no media attention and they don't build careers. Our education system also teaches us that the way to prove yourself is to come up with a single right answer. There weren't many high marks for saying it's a bit of one and a bit of the other. So, you know,
that's
which is also a really interesting question. You know, we're kind of being selected for our ability to win arguments, actually.
No, that's very true. And I wonder if, you know, and let's not underestimate the impact and how stupid we are. I mean, you know, the fact we can't make the long and the short work properly in balance, it's not rocket science, and yet there's very few companies that actually have mastered it, right? There's a few that go, I've seen it myself, go charging in with both feet into long for about 6 months and then go, oh fuck, we can't have 70% of our budget in that. we must pull it all out to short again. And again, you know, the old TV versus digital video argument, which we're still having on a daily basis, it's just stupid, but we're caught up in it, and to Rory's point, the fights keep going and we keep watching them. So, yeah, I think I mean, I just made all this shit up, obviously, for the talk. But I do think it's something that might be we might try and pull it out next year and use it a bit to beat up on individualism and on, you know, taking one side or the other and just say, what about bothism? What would be the alternative to this? Back to Rory's point about the opposite of a good idea is another good idea. Mm-hmm. Maybe there's some simple way we can catch people out and say, you know, there is the alternative, which is also to be added to this.
Yeah. And actually the opposite can also be brilliant, which is, I mean, it's a really interesting one, because you're also right to identify is the silo problem, where your professional reputation depends on your adherence to one particular narrow specialism. And your ability to win the case for it is
right.
that undoubtedly damages things enormously.
No, if you're
a digital marketer,
if you're a digital marketer, you have to be able to make the case for why digital is superior. Otherwise, your whole life is a bit past.
Yeah.
You know, if you work for the TV industry, you have to be able to demonstrate and not just, you know, pretend, but rationalize it to the degree where every morning you believe it to be true. TV remains a superior medium. And I think, you know, this is the point Tom was making in that article I referenced at the start. It is very sociological. It's very tribal. And I think that's part of our problem as well. There are very few just marketers in this world now. We're all some kind of flavor of marketing, which taints us a bit.
I've also wondered whether the need for every new, this is a very advertising specific one, the need for every new business pitch to have a ta-da moment also distorts things a bit, in that you have to narrow everything down to this inflection point whereupon you say ta-da, and the suggestion is that by focusing on this one single thing, everything, every other problem somehow goes away. And there's a narrative bias in it as well.
You're absolutely right. And even to the point where one of the things I used to try and do at business school with MBAs was teach them that the option they hadn't put on the board when we broke down a case was doing absolutely nothing. you know, it was invariably the smartest, you know.
I once saved myself hundreds of thousands of pounds by that, because we were planning to move house and were undecided between two houses. And I suddenly realized, hold on a second, we've forgotten something here. What if
Make sure all the options are considered, do nothing, and make sure and include and as well. Mark, you touched a little on the question of the lack of diversity in our industry and how that might affect that. There's a question come through from Sandra just saying, is actually the lack of bothism in boardrooms linked to that and the prevalence of the big swinging dick culture? Very specific question there.
Oh, there's a lot. I mean, there's a lot of dick swinging goes on, and still in marketing too. You know, we point the finger again at boards, and they are, yeah, there's still too many dicks, you know, on many different levels in those boardrooms. But it's not much better at senior levels in marketing as well. If we tout our numbers at the junior level, we look pretty good. But as we all know, right, as you rise through the hierarchy of marketing to senior levels, we lose so much of the diversity that we these days are starting out with, right? So I think but again, I wouldn't portray the boards to be the problem. I'd portray it to be marketing. You know, 70% of marketers were born into a household where the lead earning pair of the society we market to. Now, take our own biases in, it means that we kind of are a bit of a uniform culture. And the more we could break it up and have different points of view, I think that would help us tremendously to take two different perspectives and blend them together. I think we're an industry that talks a great game of diversity and inclusion and then just doesn't fucking do it half the time. I mean, again, I don't want to go back over, you know, hackneyed territory from the last 2 months, but Black Lives Matter made me want to puke. You know what I mean? The response of the corporate fraternity, all of these, you know, turning our sites black and turning our logos black. And as I pointed out at the time in Marketing Week, almost every single boardroom looks like a white male Scandinavian golfing outfit. You know, there were no black faces there. There was no diversity there. And the problem is the way we express, oh, we've changed our Twitter handle.
So that question there, I think, Mark, is another bothism one, which is there a way in which we can both respond from a marketing community point of view in terms of the communications we do, but also help build the brand inside out by looking at diversity inside the organizations? I think that's probably one for a whole separate conversation for us to have
good
later.
Good one though. Yeah, it's a very good one, right? That we can communicate our support for Black Lives Matter, but we have to also see it as being a significant internal challenge as well. Yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah. One of the questions that's come through, I think, is probably interesting to answer as well. How do you do bothism on a small budget? We can look at, I guess, to that, we can look at all the startups and what they've done from a marketing point of view, where they probably have been pretty ambitious with what they're doing.
Yeah, I'm interested in what Rory thinks. I'll give you my standard answer, which I do get this question quite a lot. So I would talk about bothism, or I'll talk about multi-channel, or I'll talk about superior excess share of voice, or I'll talk about, you know, outspending the competition, about differentiation and distinctiveness. And invariably somebody at a conference, real or virtual, will ask this question, which is, but what do you do on a small budget? And what I say to those people respectfully is you stay small. Yeah, you don't get big, because capitalism and marketing isn't fair. It was never fucking fair. And anyone that says, well, there's some special karate move where I, David, get to smash Goliath, that's a fairy tale, unless you believe in the Old Testament, which I suspect most people don't. It's a fairy tale, right? The reality of brands, if we could take the David and Goliath story, is Goliath beats the fuck out of David in about 3 seconds and goes home for tea. Big beats small. And I don't think that's a good thing. I don't think it's a nice thing, but I think it's a true thing. And so when people say, you know, well, you know, how do you do bothism on a limited budget? The answer is you don't. You get smashed by Google and by Amazon, because that's the way the game is played.
I do have an answer, which is obviously self-interested. But if you start with a behavioral science conversation rather than a marketing conversation, you take it out of the silo, because if you're approaching it from a behavioral science angle, you don't have a dog in the fight. You don't have an interest in, you know, favoritism towards either digital or analog, or, you know, targeted or mass. And quite often, the other advantage is you can get other people then interested in the conversation. I think marketing vocabulary, if you're in a small market, what we've got to remember, and I think agencies have missed this completely, is in a large number of huge companies, marketing is a very, very small piece of the equation. Okay. And as you said, may not be right, they may be wrong, but those are the facts. And I think what you need to do is probably win allies outside marketing for psychologically led solutions. And the problem with marketing language, as a brilliant colleague of mine, Alistair Graham, said, he said, it's like the language of astrology. If you're talking to fellow believers, you sound perfectly plausible. But if you're talking to anybody else, you sound like a loony. And so by taking, behavioral economics is an ingenious rebranding of psychology in a way that financial directors feel they have to pay attention. You know, let's be blunt about that. But that's probably a useful trick, which is you ain't going to do it alone, but see if you can enjoy influence by co-opting other people's budgets.
Well, one of the themes for us at the Marketing Society this year has been about being braver together, and this sense of togetherness, which obviously brings in the idea of community and everybody within the marketing industry working together. But it also brings in a couple of things we've talked about today. So Mark's togetherness approach in terms of bothism. We'll have some of that, and we'll have some of that. We'll have long and short term. Let's make it work together. And Rory, your point about actually we can't do this alone. Great marketeers can be fantastic, but they need to bring in those allies and they need to work together to make sure great things happen. Unfortunately, we are running out of time today to talk about this fascinating subject. So I would just like to point out that we will make sure we answer all the questions that Mark's been asked today, including the very important one, which is what type of dog he has. I love the fact that of all the amazing things you shared today, Mark, somebody noticed the dog above everything else.
Well, there was a great moment when Rory's seagulls set off my two dogs, even though they were about 12,000 miles apart.
The brilliance of doing it live.
Because a lovely moment. My dogs were trying to get at Rory's seagulls. I'm thinking, they're pretty good. They're pretty good dogs, but they're not going to get those boys, I don't think.
On the other side of the world. Yeah, the fun of life and the challenges of the technology today. Thank you, everybody, for putting up with that. And thank you so much, Mark, for an amazing lecture. I want to rewatch it and laugh at it and listen to it again. And I know everybody else listening will take a huge amount out from that. Thank you, Rory, for encouraging everybody here to talk more broadly about what marketing can do and setting extra challenges and thought provocation for everybody. Thank you for both for your time, your wisdom and your advice, and to Ogilvy for supporting the lecture today. Now, Rory talked about the fun of a fight. Fight, fight, fight. There's nothing more satisfying than seeing a little bit of creative abrasion and seeing people argue. And we've got two amazing things coming up this week, which anybody who loves a fight will enjoy. As part of the Amplify Festival, we have the Badger Debate on Wednesday. The topic of this debate is this house believes that marketeers should prioritise purpose over profit, a great subject which there's already been lots of controversy over in the marketing industry this year. So join us on Wednesday for that Badger Debate and see who wins. Also on Friday at 4, finish off your week by coming to join the Amplify Creative Challenge, where we've got clients versus agencies. And they're battling together by pitching award-winning pioneering spirit ideas using humour, something we all need right now. In fact, Ogilvy also said the best ideas come as jokes. So please join us for the rest of the Amplify Festival this week. And please keep talking to each other and to us as we work through this interesting year in 2020. We can be reached for the Marketing Society and the Marketing Society of Scotland on Twitter or LinkedIn, or come and find me and tell me what you think of today's session and this amazing Ogilvy lecture. Thank you very much, Mark. Thank you, Rory. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Stay safe, stay positive, stay thinking.